Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Hi, Teresa. Good to be back.
Good to be here. We're in show 33.
Wow.
Okay. I know. Isn't that exciting?
Yeah.
Great number. We just finished the missions.
I thought what I'd do today is kind of zero in on France, doing these under-the-radar screen kind of things, one of those things that you never think about, but every once in a while you kind of wonder at, and
mm-hmm.
that is, what was parish life like?
Oh, this will be interesting.
1700s.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And once again, it came as a question from one of my seminarians.
Mm-hmm.
One of the students asked about it, and I did a little research, and I was just really flabbergasted by it. And it helped to explain some reasons why in 1789, when the French Revolution began, most of the bishops in France were on one side, and most of the priests were on the other.
Okay.
And it's kind of interesting that happened, and I think this will explain a little bit of why.
Okay, great.
Well, in the big thing, on the big picture, we remember that King Louis XIV, the Sun King,
mm-hmm.
Had finally reconciled with Rome in 1693. This as a result of his own difficulties with the Jansenists.
Right.
And then afterwards, just 2 years later, the First Estate, which is the church, then gave Louis a gift of 4 million livres. I remember that the church was not taxed in
mm-hmm.
In France, but at the same time they did each year give an annual gift to the king
okay.
to be used for various purposes.
Okay.
Okay. And this will come into play also in the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens with that also. So things seem to be pretty good on the national level. Now we have Rome and Versailles once again on the same page, which is always good to have. And then also Louis did something for the bishops. That remember that he has a lot of control over what's going on in France, the appointments of bishops and things of that nature. He has a lot of influence in that. And in 1698, in December of 1698, he gave a royal decree supporting the bishops' authority over and against the within France itself. And this becomes really important because the bishops had a lot of their authority curtailed in France, and now this begins to change with new authority within their own diocese. For one thing, they were authorized to restrict preachers within their own diocese.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
But believe it or not, until almost 1700, these itinerant preachers
mm-hmm.
Could just go into your diocese. Now, sometimes that works out real well. For instance, when you have somebody like St. Vincent de Paul giving conferences, you know, or St. Alphonsus Liguori, or St. Francis de Sales, you know. But then you had some other real
I'm sure there's others. Not quite up to that.
Yeah, yeah. And this was especially important during Advent and Lent. There were a lot of itinerant
uh-huh.
preachers coming in and giving retreats and conferences to parishes and things of that nature. And now the bishop has more control over who's going to be coming in to his diocese. Also, he's going to have much more say in who will be hearing confessions. Priests hearing confessions in other in other parishes and,
mm-hmm.
and those sorts of things. So there's a little bit more of that. And then he also gives the authority. This is kind of humorous or interesting. The king gives the authority to the bishops that they can send any priest that displeases them. Any of their diocesan priests who displease them, they can send them to the seminary for 3 months.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So, you know, interesting. But I guess a little re-education kind of it. So, as a result, the bishops now are actually getting greater authority within their own diocese. The loser in this is going to be the pastors of the parishes.
Right.
Their authority will be curtailed. And added to that is another another burden that parishes carry in France due to another minister of Louis XIV's government. His name is Louvois, and he is basically the Secretary of Defense, or the Secretary of War. He's the man who really organizes the modern army as we understand it today.
Okay.
It's not until the late 1600s that, you know, you have a truly organized national army, and Louvois is really the one who does this. And what he does is, in order to get a constant source of manpower, because before, how you basically got your army was you either hired mercenaries or you literally stole people. You pressed them into service. Now what he does is he introduces the notion of a national service that all males would need to serve. And the way he does that is he looks around France and he says, now how can I get a hold of every male? And he goes, the grade schools.
Okay.
And what he does is he designates classes. And so starting in 1688, you have the grammar school graduating class of 1688, and all the boys throughout France who are graduating from their grade schools. And most of these schools, remember now, are parochial, parish schools.
Mm-hmm.
There is no public school system.
Right.
You do have private schools, the Riding Masters, but the vast majority are parish schools. So here now becomes the source of the soldiers. Not that they're going to be drafted that year, but that's the year that they're designated.
Okay.
And immediately he has a source of 25,000 men. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you're 13, 14 years old, you're in the class of 1688, you graduate from your grade school, and then the government, they've got their eyes on you.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll watch you now for the next 4 years. You'll go off and you'll apprentice someplace and you'll work as a young farmhand, or you'll work in town as a cobbler or whatever you're going to be doing. And then after you reach around 16, 17 years old, they say, okay, report for duty.
Okay.
You see it?
Mm-hmm.
But the deal is that the person who's responsible to bring these guys in is the pastor of the parish.
Oh.
I mean, as if he doesn't have enough responsibility.
Really?
You know? And then not only that, but since Louvois didn't have the money to give these guys uniforms, because he felt that everyone should wear a uniform, everyone should have a gun and all that, he then passes the expense on to
the pastor.
Parish.
Oh, no. Oh.
And not only that, but also in those days, they didn't fight during the wintertime.
Uh-huh.
And so what they did was they had what was called a winter quarters. And so these soldiers now are under the hire of the king. But it's the parish that has to pay for their winter quartering. So this is a tremendous difficulty. And on top of all of this, if the kid decides, I don't think I want to do this, I'm going to emigrate to the United States, to the American colonies, or whatever, the New World, if he jumps, it now becomes the responsibility of the pastor to find another young man to take his place and to hire that person to pay for it.
Now, oh, my goodness.
Nowadays, we call that an unfunded mandate.
Right.
And that's exactly what it was. And so all this falls onto the parish priest. This becomes his responsibility. The king realizes that he's got something really good here. He's got an organization already, I mean, nationally, all over. And since everybody in France, with the exception of the small group of Huguenots, the vast majority of people of France went to church on Sunday. That meant that if he could get into the hands of the parish priest any message,
mm-hmm.
the entire French country would hear this message within 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
That's tremendous. And he used it. So now what happens is that on the parish level now, a parish becomes a unit, in a sense, of royal administration. So, if he wants to send out word about something to everybody, he just prints this out. It's then delivered all throughout France to all of the pastors. And then that Sunday at the end of Mass, just like we read letters from the Archbishop, here's a letter from the king. And so you can see how they're the parishes then are being used for purposes other than, of course, what they were founded for.
Right.
At the time of the Revolution, these parishes, which were also known as terroirs, are simply going to be morphed into a revolutionary form called a commune.
Mm-hmm.
And so these
mm-hmm.
will be these communes. The parishes itself are founded in a different way than our parishes are today. Today, the bishop of a diocese perceives a need for a parish. He then orders one to be erected, and then a pastor is sent out, and they begin the building process and all of that. In France, in the 1700s, typically what happened was you had a patron. Often a wealthy individual, or it might be a committee of people, who would then finance the parish itself. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, the patrons themselves didn't even live in the parish.
Hmm.
They might be a distant relative of whoever the founder of the parish was. And they would continue supporting that parish. So it's also different. The way that parishes were supported was different. You know, today we have envelopes and we make contributions on a regular basis. Some people tithe. And all of that was expected also, but often the parishes receive a large portion of their money from someone else.
And then would the people then know who was that parish's sponsor, and then they would then pray for that person? Is that the idea?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. In some cases, the parish was named after the patron saint of that individual.
Okay.
I believe that in River Auvaz, in this diocese, I think that Saints Philip and James Parish were named after two individuals who had helped to found that parish.
Really?
In St. Genevieve County. I believe that is true. I know of another parish here in the Archdiocese that for many, many years the parish was very poor and couldn't continue to support itself, and that a donor from Europe sent a large sum of money to help that parish year after year, and in fact renovated the church.
Oh my goodness.
And it's only in the last couple of years that the last heir of that
family
has died out, and that money now has shriveled up. But so this is extraordinary, but it's not totally unheard of.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. Also, in some cases, you might have it might be a bishop that would oversee that. It could be an abbey from an abbot of a monastery that might do that instead. Sometimes it's the family, and they would have then control over who the pastor was going to be.
Okay.
They had a tremendous say in who that would be. Typically, in France, the term for the pastor was a curé.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, we've got a parish here in St. Louis, the curé of
Ars.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, in the legal term for a pastor in France was a vicaire. Like a vicar. But interestingly enough, in Brittany, in the peninsula of Brittany in western France, the pastor was often referred to as a rector.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we get the term rectory from that today. So these are all common terms. The number one duty of a pastor in his parish, and this is grounded in regulations that come from the Council of Trent.
Okay.
Number one duty was, as one might think, sacramental.
Right.
Okay, so besides all the other governmental responsibilities he has, his number one responsibility is sacramental, especially baptisms, marriages, funerals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it was his responsibility to register all of these.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever find yourself working around in a rectory, you know how very important and very meticulous the records are kept, especially concerning baptisms. They're very, very important, and every parish prides themselves on those records. And so certainly since the time of Trent, which of course now this means it's a real treasure for genealogists.
Right, definitely.
Because it's an easy way to trace ancestry back then. And so those records are kept. After 1668, not only is it a rule of the church, But it also is it's also a royal decree that decreed that these records should be kept. Because once again, Louis XIV understood very well the importance of using the entity of the Catholic parish for his own purposes. The priest then, the pastor, would then act as a judicial assistant. Okay. It even became his responsibility during the reign of Louis XIV, the responsibility of the pastor, occasionally, to advertise the sale of property in his parish.
Oh my gosh.
When requested. Isn't that the strangest thing?
It really is.
You know? Although, interestingly enough, we still get that today. Occasionally, a parishioner will come in and say, I'm selling my house, and is there some way of advertising it? You know, so the bulletin board in the back are, you know, sometimes is used for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've had people ask about doing that with bulletins. I remember one woman had a stray dog, and she asked if we could put something in the bulletin. Well, why not, you know? It was his responsibility also to oversee the parish cemetery, and practically all parishes had a cemetery at the time. And not only did he cemetery, but there was also another building called an ossuary, because the unlike here in the United States, where we have lots and lots of room, and we sort of look upon our cemeteries as being sacred spots, mm-hmm. and green spaces, you know, gardens in a sense, and perpetual care. In much of Europe, you don't buy your plot; you actually rent it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so like 70, 75 years after you're buried, you're then dug up, and the bones are placed in another location, an ossuary.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. I've never heard that.
Isn't that something?
That is very interesting.
I've always been so impressed with the cemeteries in Germany. They're so beautiful, and the families keep them up so well. But I was shocked when I found out that you're only renting it for, I think it's 75 years, something like that. And then it's exhumed, and then it's either sold to someone else in the family or to someone else.
Okay, another side thought then. Do you suppose that's how we found a lot of the bodies that were held are incorrupt?
I never thought of that. That's a good point.
Possibly that was just...
Possibly. The only time I've been involved in a case like that, and thanks be to God it didn't go through, was there was a very, very holy Christian brother that there were those who thought that perhaps his body was incorrupt, and there was a move on to have it exhumed, and mm-hmm. I was a novice at the time. I would have been one of those digging, and luckily we found something else to do. I never got around to it, but that would be the other way, of course, would be because of the holiness of the
Sure, right. I would assume that would be the first response at finding, you know, that you would only exhume those that were considered to have been very holy people, but
ultimately everybody would be.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point. But that's not true, by the way, of military cemeteries.
Okay.
Visited the military cemeteries around the battlefield of Verdun, mm-hmm. and they're in perpetual care there, including over 10,000 Americans mm-hmm. are buried in that. There is, however, a huge, huge monument on the top of one of the hills. It's a giant ossuary, and what that is, it is filled with bones of unidentified soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Just phenomenal. But anyway, that's one other building that they had to take care of. You also had to take care of the rectory, mm-hmm. the house itself. Generally, there was a garden involved, and take care of that. The church building itself, that was the responsibility of the pastor to take care of that. And if there was a school, that was his responsibility to take care of that. All the other goods of the parish, and often including cattle and sheep, all of that, chickens, all of that was his responsibility. I think if there are any priests listening to this program, they're thinking, yeah, things haven't changed much.
Right.
You know, it is an awesome responsibility mm-hmm. to do all of this.
Definitely.
He had some help, and Well, once again, it depends on who the individuals are. But he was aided by a group called the Fabrique, which was basically a parish council.
Mm-hmm.
And the parish council, because most of these towns, you know, in France, Germany, Italy, Spain, you visit throughout Western Europe, and if you visit a relatively small town or village, the center, of course, is always the church, and then the town sort of goes out
around
from
it.
There. Yeah, and so the parish council, in many cases, was also the local body politic. You know, and so they ran the village as well as ran the parish itself. These are the people who would be responsible then for keeping the buildings in repair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're going to be helping the pastor. He's responsible for them to be kept in repair. They're the ones who are going to be doing that for him. Leasing church lands. A lot of times the churches had much more property way beyond their own parish campus, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Farmland, forests, vineyards. These were perhaps purchased generations earlier by a very industrious pastor, or in some cases they were willed
mm-hmm.
to the parish, given to the parish in exchange for various things. It's going to be this group that's going to collect revenues, and it's also this group who is going to pay the priest for endowed masses.
Mm-hmm.
This was not uncommon also, that, and of course we continued that custom of intending a mass for a specific individual. And once again, you'd have numbers of this. Again, I remember talking to a pastor of a parish that was financially strapped, in terrible shape, but a huge endowment had been given to that particular parish that masses be said for a particular individual. And he told me that if he were there the rest of his life, there would probably be enough money to do that.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, and this, of course, was at that time a very important part of the income of a priest,
uh-huh.
especially since his regular salary was so terrible, which I'll say some things about in a couple
hasn't
minutes.
Changed.
Yeah. It's also going to be the Fabrique, the parish council, that will be hiring visiting preachers, especially during Lent and during Advent, at least up until 1695,
right.
when the bishop gets control over that. Well, the revenue, the income of the parish priest and the parish was basically based upon what was called, and I quote here, the tithe of the fruits of the earth.
Okay.
So the tithe that is given, one-third of the tithe is given to the priest for his own support.
Okay.
One-third of that money is then, or one-third of that, whatever it is.
Whatever it was.
Yeah,
right?
Is going to be given to the buildings, just the maintenance of the buildings. And then one-third of it is designated to go to the poor.
Oh.
Okay, so it's going to be for relief for basically what we have today is St. Vincent de Paul Society.
Mm-hmm.
So if you would imagine a parish budget today, when you think about it, I mean, that's kind of cushy. Let's say you have $1 million budget,
okay?
And so that would mean that about $300,000 would go to support the parish plant, the
mm-hmm.
buildings, the school, all of those sorts of things. $300,000 is not going to buy you much as far as a school goes. They're very expensive propositions. But it means that the poor would be, there'd be $300,000 available to help the poor throughout that year.
Right.
Okay, what about the other third?
That goes to the pastor.
$300,000, yeah.
That sounds pretty good.
That sounds pretty good, but the reality is that
they're worth no $1 million.
No.
You get a third of a chicken, right?
Yeah, that's about, right. Yeah, not necessarily the best part either. It's not nearly as good as it sounds.
Uh-huh.
There are exceptions to all of this. So although everyone was expected to tithe, there were a lot of people who were given privileges that didn't have to tithe.
Okay.
For instance, the family that founded the parish,
mm-hmm.
they're going to give large sums of money anyway for the mm-hmm. support of that parish. So they would have the privilege of not having to tithe,
mm-hmm.
obviously. Others perhaps performed some great service. Maybe they were the ones who saw the church on fire and ran and put the fire out one night. And so they received then a privilege for the rest of their lives or whatever. If not, so anyway, you have various groups that don't have to pay for all this. The cure himself has to pay a tithe.
Okay.
If he owns property or makes money within his own parish, that all of that then goes to that. Let me give you an example. Let's say that the priest owns a vineyard. Okay. He then is expected to tithe to whatever parish that vineyard is in.
Okay.
So in some ways, if he owns a vineyard within his own parish, then he tithes to,
His own parish.
Yeah, quite honestly, most priests that I know tithe in to their own parish also. So that in some way hasn't changed all that terribly much. Everyone is supposed to pay, including the Protestants.
Okay, this is interesting. How they do that?
Well, this is an established church. This is an established church. The French, the Catholic Church in France is the established church.
Okay.
And so, just as in England, everyone paid tithes to the Church of England, including the Catholics. In France, the Huguenots were expected to pay, even after the Edict of Nantes, they were allowed to have their own religious programs. They still continued paying to the Catholic, local Catholic Church. But when you consider that what the Catholic Church did,
what they took care of,
it did a lot of government things also, as I said, reading royal decrees, supplying soldiers for the army, taking care of them during the wintertime. It's more than just a religious body. And so that's why they were expected then to pay also.
Okay.
Yeah. The occupier of the land was expected to pay the tithe, not necessarily the owner of the land.
Oh, okay.
So if you were a tenant farmer in a particular parish, you paid that tithe, not the owner of the property itself. And it was, as you hinted before, based in kind. It might be chickens. You know, it might be grain, it might be wine. The tithe was to be paid on what was called the increase of livestock, so that if you had three cows and the next year you had a fourth cow come along, a little calf, now you've got four cows, you paid the 10% of that one calf.
Okay.
So whatever that calf was considered the fair market value, you then paid a tithe on that. It gets really complicated also because of interpretations. Like, for instance, fruit. If you have fruit trees on tithable land, now tithable land is meadow land, it's the natural land, then you pay the tithe on that. But if you bought a piece of land and you tore out all of the growth, undergrowth, and everything, and you planted an orchard, and it was enclosed. Okay, in other words, it was developed. If you did that, you do not have to pay tithes on that.
Okay. Why?
Why? I don't know.
Okay.
I don't think anybody knew. That's part of the problem. It was not necessarily a tithe on income. But it has to do with you tithe
the fruit
on
the
fruit of the earth. Yeah, the increase of the crop, of the flock. The rate of tithing, too, we all assume is 10%. But in actuality, it was a variable rate. It could be as little as 3%. Typically, the readings that I did, I found that the tithes ran somewhere between 3 and 8%. And it's not 3 to 8% of gross income, you know, which we would think of today. It's 3 to 8% of the increase of fruit of the land. Which is quite different.
It's very different.
Yeah. And now that's supposed to go to the curé.
And
he's supposed to then take that money and, as I say, break it into thirds for his parish. Now, we were saying that one-third of that was his, but in 90% of the time, there are exceptions, but in 90% of the time, he was expected to give part of his income to the local bishop.
Mm-hmm.
And this was part of the bishop's income, mm-hmm. was from all of the priests. Not only that, he was also expected to give money to the chapter of canons in the at the cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
He was also expected, if there were any monasteries nearby, he was expected to give a tithe of his income to the monasteries, or if there are any convents, to the convents. Often, a majority of his income was paid out in various tithes to different people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. This becomes a really big deal. And that's why most of the priests in the 18th century, the 1700s, were quite poor.
Right.
There was a lot of money circulating. In fact, it was believed that as much as between 100 and 150 million livres, which is the French currency at the time, which is a lot of money, was being churned as basically a national tax, the tithe as a national tax. This is going to be one of the real bones of contention at the time of the French Revolution, doing away with tithes and a number of others. We'll look at this when we get to the revolution itself.
Okay.
But to give something of a background, you can see, I think, why it was just very unwieldy, very complicated, and why the parish priests themselves would have been very happy to get rid of this system and try to get more reasonable system underway.
Right.
Yeah. He had some other very important duties. I mentioned to you that it's very important for him to baptize.
Mm-hmm.
To baptize and to register the baptism is very important, because not only is this a sacrament and the number one introductory sacrament into the life of the church, but it's also the introduction into the citizenship of a Frenchman.
Oh, okay.
If you were not baptized, you were not considered to be alive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was
you weren't?
Well, that's right, spiritually. But you were considered to be non-existent if you weren't baptized. And so whether you're baptized Catholic or Huguenot, you better get yourself baptized.
Baptized,
you
uh-huh.
know. Of course, communion is a very important thing. The pastor oversaw communion. And what communion did, when you received first communion, the reason why it was so important is because it brought you into adulthood within the community.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of still see that. You know, mm-hmm. it's one of the neat things about the distribution of communion. When you're distributing communion, and you ever notice people carrying their babies up, you know, and the baby, or sometimes little child, and maybe the priest or the deacon is about to bless them, you know, and they look up and they put their hand up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, why can't I have? you know, and it's sort of like, well, wait a couple years. It's coming, you know, and that enthusiasm, you like to
so
really,
cute. I love
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it really is. But in France, the added addition to that was once you received communion, now you entered into the adult community of believers. The
at this time, communion wasn't at 7, right?
You know, I don't.
Probably it was later.
I can't tell you that for a fact, but from just pictures that I've seen of rural drawings, the children are quite young receiving communion.
I was just thinking back to St. Therese, and I realize that she's 1900s, but
yeah.
But she was still young when she received.
Yeah, and I so remember seeing some German and Austrian artists and renditions of, now once again, this would be about 1800 to 1830, and First Communion procession, those were little kids. They would be about second to fifth graders,
okay.
just like we would today.
Okay.
So it seems to be but
similar.
I don't know that for a fact. It's
okay.
just my impression from artists. The other thing, too, would be keeping a record of Easter communion.
Of Easter
Believe
communion?
Believe it or not, the Easter obligation brought prosecution if you failed. If you did not receive
wow.
communion during the Easter season, you could be prosecuted for it.
Oh, my gosh.
That's something. Registering marriages.
Can't imagine that anymore.
yeah, that's for sure. You had the obligation, of course, to marry and to register the marriages. They had the connotation was, of course, that it was a legal document. French Revolution is going to do some damage to that concept. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that when that comes. But then, of course, then also to it was the obligation of the curé to bury the dead, mm-hmm. and and make sure that a funeral would be arranged, to care for the vulnerable. Anyone coming to the pastor's door could expect to receive some kind of help. Mm-hmm. Anyone, remember, there is no government welfare at this time.
Right.
It is all dependent upon the parish charity. And then also it's his obligation to educate the illiterate. That's a very hard task. You know, in 1685, it was estimated that 80% of the population of France was illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that in 1680, the Jean-Baptiste de La Salle founded the Christian Brothers and began the process of schooling and using the simultaneous method and mm-hmm. many, many other innovations. And, of course, that order grew rapidly throughout the late 16th and throughout the 1700s. Interestingly enough, by 1785, so a century later, on the verge of the French Revolution, the illiteracy rate in France was 63%. So it had gone from 80% down to 63%. That's a
phenomenal progress.
It really mm-hmm. is. It's a mm-hmm. tremendous progress. And it's also one of the factors of the French Revolution because mm-hmm. so many people now could read. Mm-hmm. They could read other people's grievances and, mm-hmm. Communication was better. This increase in literacy was due specifically to the parish schools and to the writing masters. The writing masters, of course, basically taking care of the middle class, the parish schools taking care of the poor, the rural poor, the urban poor, and the middle class, and then some religious orders taking, of course, mm-hmm. care of the wealthy, mm-hmm. either in schools, academies, or in tutors,
right.
one or the other. But interestingly enough, the vast majority of the muckamucks, the intellectual elites of the age, the philosophers,
mm-hmm.
were against universal education.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got some great quotes that I'll dig up in which they considered that teaching the poor was the worst possible thing because it would make them aware of their poverty and then make them unhappy.
Right.
Far better if they were ignorant. In fact, the one of the philosophers used to refer to the Christian Brothers specifically as les frères ignorants,
mm-hmm.
The ignorant brothers, mm-hmm. Punning off of their French title, the Frères des Écoles Chrétiennes, the brothers of the Christian schools.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of ignorance. in the 1700s, and it's kind of almost humorous about some of these. I've got some observations. I'd just like to read some of them to you. They're kind of funny stories that were going on in some of the parishes at the time. You have one. Well, let me just read this to you. It's so funny. This is a little history of coming from one of the parishes, and it says, in June of 1681, parishioners of La Madeleine obtained a monetary contra vermis, against vermin, and walked in procession to fumigate it. In the month of August, the vicar general is asked for an order of excommunication against the wasps.
Oh my gosh.
Which were causing a lot of damage at the time. In June of 1684, the order excommunicating earthworms is renewed. Isn't that a riot? These cases are as common as entries for rain, entreaties for rain or fine weather on the relics of Saint Prothad. I guess he must have been a local saint.
Oh my God! Watch out if you're a worm.
So you can imagine that. I'm going back to that embattled
pastor.
He's got everything going on. He's, you know, he's got the government down on him saying, you know, you got to provide soldiers and you know, and he's got, you know, somebody else comes in and says, I want to advertise my house, I'm moving, and then everything else, and then a committee comes in. Yeah, go out and excommunicate a wasp or an earthworm. I don't know. There are other things. Another problem.
It might have brought him a little levity to his life. I don't know.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and once again, doesn't this show us the importance of seminary formation?
Definitely.
He might have taken it serious if he hadn't gone to seminary himself, you know. There was a great concern in the late 1600s, rather, in early 1700s, about witches.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, on top of everything else, could you imagine somebody showing up at your rectory and saying, oh, you know, we've got a problem down the street. We've got this witch and stuff like that. Once again, let me read you another one of these chronicles. These things are just a riot. This one is written in 1679, okay? And this is it. It's describing this. It says, the leaves fell from the trees and shriveled, and the fruit remained upon them. And creatures like mice were seen running up the trees, only they had no ears, and it was thought to be witchcraft. On the 20th day of September, the peasants stoned three witches out of the village of Epinay and drove them towards Seclin, where one was killed and then chased the others as far as the mills of Lille at the Port de Malade, half dead, and so broken by stoning that they could barely move. So here are three women who are accused of witchery, and one of them is and they're driven from the town, and one of them is literally killed, stoned to death, and the other two were chased all the way to the city of Lille, where they had been stoned so badly that they could hardly move. You know, and there are just lots of chronicles.
Oh my gosh!
Parish chronicles talking about these kind of things that were going on. There's another one about a werewolf in 1683. Another one about this poor young woman who was attacked by a devil in 1664. You could just, you know, go on and on about.
Where did you get these?
You know, it's from a book, and it's called The Documents and of the Ancien Régime. I'll have to see if I can get you a better citation on that,
because they
are just a riot sitting there. You know, and the poor pastor has to deal with all of this. There are some people that claim that they could read the Book of Nature.
Oh.
These are, in some cases, herbalists.
Mm-hmm.
There is a concept in herbal studies called the doctrine of herbal signatures. And what it is if you look at a particular herb, and herbs that are shaped in the form of a heart are considered to be good toward taking care of heart ailments.
Mm-hmm.
Others that have kidney signs are supposedly for kidneys and all like that. There is no doubt that herbs are medicinal.
Well, and that's where our medicine comes from, primarily.
Right. Yeah, lots of it, mm-hmm. and certainly it is. I think much more studied and in higher regard in Europe, especially in Germany. I found that herbalism is considered to be quite a high science than here in the United States, where we tend to want to take pills for mm-hmm. everything. But this kind of got out of hand in the late 1600s in France, and you do have a lot of people being accused of witchery,
mm-hmm.
and of course we had the experience right here in the United States, at the time of the American colonies, among the Puritans in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, mm-hmm. and then of course probably the worst anywhere in the world was the a terrible burning of women in Scotland.
Where right.
as much as 1% of the population
right.
was burned at the stake, you know. England, a lot of witch hunts going on there, you know, so it's a pretty ubiquitous all over the place, and it has to do really with the ignorance of